摩訶般若波羅蜜多心経観自在菩薩行深般若波羅蜜多智照見御恩皆苦道一切苦薬捨離し四季不異苦苦不異四季四季即是苦苦即是四季十相行四季薬不如是捨離し是諸法苦相不諸不滅不苦不浄不増不減是苦苦中無色無住相行色無減に微絶身に無色性光未即法無限界内し無意識界無無明薬無無明人内し無老し薬無老し人無苦修滅道無知薬無得意無所得故菩提薩多へ般若波羅蜜多故心無けげ無けげ故無不苦不本理一切天道無相苦行涅槃三世諸仏へ般若波羅蜜多故徳阿耨多羅三藐三菩提高智般若波羅蜜多是大臣主是大名主是無上主是無尊主の上一切苦真実不空空説般若波羅蜜多諸即説諸瓦諸耶帝耶帝波羅耶帝波羅蘇耶帝摩諸娑婆訶般若心経。
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Poet Radio. Today we have another special program with Robert Kelly as my guest in WGXE's Hudson Studio. Kelly has published more than 60 books of poems, and as a reader of his work the past 25 years, I have no doubt that he is one of our country's most magnificent poets. This is once again proven to an audience two nights ago at Star Library in Rhinebeck, where he read from a new book, Heart Threads, and also from a writing project focused on Haydn, as well as some brand new work that included a marvelous piece about crocodiles. Mm-hmm. Kelly's poetry and writing, wide-ranging in its attention, is, as the Poetry Foundation's website tells us, quote, often engaged with the intimacy of audience, the connection forged between individuals looking outward together, unquote. He's the recipient of many honors, the most recent of which is being named as the first ever poet laureate of Dutchess County. He's a professor at Bard College, where he was a founding member of the Milton Avery Graduate School and also co-directs the program in written arts. Needless to say, we're extremely fortunate to be part of that same literary arts community as Robert Kelly, and it's an honor to have him with me today in this, the National Month of Poetry. Thank you for coming down, Robert.
Thank you for having me. Being poet laureate is a strange and interesting thing, and I have you, Christopher, to thank for it, since you nominated me, as far as I could tell.
True.
Therefore, whenever I'm out in the snow reading poetry to the sheep, I'll blame you. But it's rather wonderful that Molinaro, who's the county executive, and the whole board there, decided to have a poet laureate in the first place. It's kind of immaterial whether it's me or another, but that there's someone representing the arts, the verbal arts in particular, but art in general, at that level of semi-institutional alertness.
Right, right.
In England, the poet laureate was meant to praise the king and write poems for ceremonial occasions. I haven't been asked to do anything like that because we have a kind of a purer vision of it, that the poet, by laureating or laureling one person, you're really laureling the art, and they're honoring the whole art. There are hundreds and hundreds of writers in Dutchess County and Ulster and Green and all around in Columbia. And more of them are drifting into Columbia, I'm afraid, but your loss, our loss, your gain. Anyway.
But you did write a poem. I watched the inauguration on the internet when it was happening, streaming, and it did seem like you wrote a poem for the county or for the magistrate.
I wrote a poem for him saying, get on with it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's get on with it. Let's do it. Not urging him to do something he wasn't doing, but trying to join him in doing something that he was very intent on doing.
Right.
That is, setting up the world. But I don't know. It feels very peculiar to have any kind of connection with the government other than paying taxes.
Yeah, I bet. And I have no idea whose idea it was. It was one of the Mid-Hudson arts groups that organized it. I don't know how, who thought of it or why, but I remember when I contacted you with the idea, or maybe it was Charlotte, I'm not sure who said it, but it'd be great as long as I don't have to do too much. I hope they're not working you too hard there as a poet.
No, they're not yet. Well, I've been doing a lot this poetry month and a few more things to do within it. But not in general. They've been very helpful and respectful. They don't all know quite what to do with a poet. They're going to figure that out. Do you send them to a school? Do you send them to a library? Do you
send them in the sheep fields? All the hills echo it and
no,
all
what?
That. No, I was quoting Blake there. Oh, do they send you out to the fields?
The fields. Well, I'm expecting at any moment that.
That would be a funny...
The cows may need me.
Right.
The cows like to give milk to Mozart. They might like to give milk to poetry, too.
I don't see you too much as a conceptual writer, so it wouldn't work as a,
And I have no irony. I have no sense of irony at all. So I would be good for animals.
Right.
Because animals have no irony. Poor humans developed it in New York City a few years ago. So sad, so sad. Something in the water down there, I think.
Well, it seems like ideal in its ideal form, the position and the impetus to put poetry out there in the public would be bringing poetry to people who might not already get it. So, I mean, that, especially with you in the saddle, must be good for the community, I mean, I would say.
I love the idea of a poem coming through the air to someone, as on the radio now, or just at a reading or some vague other way. There was a time, remember, back in, maybe 20 years ago, when they started putting poems up in the subway.
That's right.
So there'd be Miss Subways, and then there'd be subway verse, and then there'd be something else. Didn't seem to last. But the notion of giving a word suddenly, because words are sudden, and words are very seminal and powerful in starting things off, and all it takes is one poem or one word.
Right. Well, that's like the flicker of light, or the amulet of quick surprise, like Creeley.
At that reading in Rhinebeck you spoke of the other night, your daughter was present, and as I was reading, I looked up from time to time and saw that she was reading. Now, I know she, a girl...
She was writing.
Was writing.
Yeah, yeah.
That she, a girl of 16, was writing, and I think she was writing from, for, against, with, some preposition connecting what she was hearing with what she was writing. And that, to me, is the grand thing about language, that it is ours. It's the one thing that is peculiar to us and the one thing that we can give to each other. It's the gift that the poor can give the rich, because, eloquence is the only art that is free, the only one that requires no material whatever.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, as the Irish, the poor Irish know it, the poor blacks know it in signifying and the dozens. Mm-hmm. Eloquence is the weapon of the poor and can also be the gift of the poor. I'm not claiming poverty anymore.
Right, right. Well, I'll have to ask Stella about that. I'm not the kind of dad who goes through the kids' notebooks to see what she's, writing in her diary. But she is active, and it's interesting that you noticed that.
Oh, it made me so happy to see it, someone writing.
I know that. I know how much she and I both loved the crocodile piece that you read.
I'll read that a bit.
Oh, all right, yeah, all right, all right. It was.
If you don't think it's too frightening in the sound of the whales to read about crocodiles.
I don't think that would be a problem at all. But we might as well just go on with this a little bit about writing, because one of the things you said in the question period after the reading the other night, as you were saying, a writer needs to practice, a writer needs to write every day, and you have some strong, you know, feelings about that, as a teacher for 50 years, you probably know what's best.
Well, I once knew a lovely man, now passed away, who was a Marxist in disposition, and he was a great teacher, and I asked him once, what is your goal in life? I don't know why I asked him. It seemed a stupid and perhaps impertinent question. But his answer thrilled me. He said, I want to make everybody into a communist. And while I don't want to make anybody into a communist, and I think that's a rather dumb thing to do, I want to make everybody into a poet. Poet in the sense that Emerson uses the word, someone who goes out and discovers something for herself, something that she didn't know about before, something that we as a people didn't know about before, and it could be in any format. So in that sense, in urging people to write every day, I realize that the more they write, the more likely they are to be open to something they don't know. As long as you're writing about what you know, especially what you know from experience, you're not going to learn much. You're going to rant or vent or declare, or write a memoir. All of that's interesting. There's nothing wrong with that. But you're not going to discover El Dorado. You're not going to discover the new science or the new world, because that only comes from writing what you don't know.
Right. I was listening to a recording I made of Amiri Baraka about 15 years ago, and it was at a workshop for young people. And he was saying, asking the crowd, and this was all high school, it was the Dodge Poetry Festival, and he says, he's calling on different people, what do you write about? I write about love, I write about this, and this young person said, I really write for myself. And he just took a step back. He said, you write for yourself? I don't want to read it. Give me something, you know, give me something more, you know, if it's, this should be more, you know, breaking in boundaries through the practice of writing, you know, or doing the exploring new territory. But I also have the sense, maybe I was incorrect, in that, you know, there has to be a kind of steadiness to it. If you drop out and you say you don't write, I mean, it's hard these days because expression is so multimedia. Mm-hmm. And yes, poetry is different than taking a picture or making a video clip, but there are a lot of ways that one can be poetically projective. But anyway, the idea that if you really want to do it and you're going to be passionate about it, that, you know, I think this is true, you know,
you do it all the time,
right? You know? And one, you know, I don't mean to be cynical, but the, you know, if you take 100 photographs, one of them is bound to be good. If you write 100 poems, and you kind of indicated this the other day, if you keep writing, eventually you're going to hit something. You're going to get something that...
You're going to write something that you didn't know you knew, and that's the great moment. Well, the Keatsian sense of negative capability, that's built into the romantic perception of writing and into the English literary canon, the notion that you can say something you don't believe, and I would extend it to say you can say something you don't know. When I first began teaching at Bard, Heinrich Blücher, that wonderful old German philosopher, husband of Hannah Arendt, made a critique of poetry by saying, quoting Aristotle and saying, The trouble with poetry is that you can say things that you cannot think. And I said, that's exactly the power of poetry. That liberates us from the rational and the irrational both. It gives us the world in the new. Anyway, that's. I'm glad you picked up on that and said it here, because I feel like I can thus speak this heresy about writing a lot.
Well, I mean, I feel very fortunate that, you know, this is a coincidence of your reading, getting to hear you read and talk the other night, and have you here. It's like, I was well prepared thanks to the your appearance in Rhinebeck, and it was nice to hear poetry in Rhinebeck, right?
Because
we don't. I mean, over at T Space, I hear some poetry, but it's not something that happens every day. Let's put it that way. Well, maybe now would be a good time to.
And tonight, for example, the 21st, there's the great celebration for Anne Lauterbach at Bard at 6 o'clock. Well, a wonderful American poet who's. Wonderful sense of tensile music. The music sustains and bears up a remarkably intellectual focus of the work, so that her work is both lucid and emotional, playful and earnest at once. And there's a big celebration of that at 6 o'clock.
Is it a one evening event?
There is something that follows it. I don't know the details of that, but the public event is this evening at 6.
And where is an event like that publicized? And one would go to Bard College?
We have a newsletter that comes out, or daily calendar.
It would be on a Bard website?
Certainly. If you go to Bard, you put in inside.bard.edu, you'll see what's happening today.
Well, we're fortunate. I feel fortunate as a newcomer to the Hudson Valley and, you know, to Dutchess County, that Bard is there and it is so active. And I don't really make a distinction between Annandale on Hudson and Rhinebeck, but there is a little bit of that. I mean, it's not what I was referring to anyway was Rhinebeck. Yes, occasional poetry reading at the library. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but there is. We don't have to go far to get good poetry.
And you can move to the south, too, because I think Dutchess has, and certainly Vassar has, poets in residence and poetry going on.
And Woodstock, weren't you just, did that happen already, the Woodstock
Writers
Festival?
Yeah, last Saturday.
Right? There's a number of people there.
Day.
And, well, we're lucky to have all of it. But now maybe... good time to see what the poet laureate of Dutchess County is up to with his poems. You want to read a bit?
What is he up to? Surely. What I'd like to do is to say that for the past, I guess, decade, I've been working on a series of long poems, the last of which was written last summer and I'm revising it, working on it now. What I'd like to do is to read a passage from each of the previous four, give you a sense of the constraints with which they operate. These are long poems. Each is about 150 pages long in various forms, so it's quite a massive series. It's not one poem, but it's a linked series of poems. The first is called Fire Exit, and the title both suggests fleeing from a movie theater when you're bored to death with the movie in it, but it also suggests escaping hell, escaping purgatory. The format, the constraint involves three-line stanzas, and therefore it looks like, as I used to tease myself by calling it Dante Light. And I'll read the first of each of these, and you'll see the difference, if that's okay. So this is the first section of Fire Exit. When I'm inside you, I don't understand the way you understand yourself. Everything else is a meadow. Inside the house is coal mine, dangerous. Some punctuation down the heart of earth that changes the meanings of what we do. The irrelevant grammar of flowers, no one picked, fall from the sky. Still, it's dark in here. Gases from breath is the last community of all. Learn to be a wheel, is what he said. The one who, at the door into the rock, wroth with me, spoke, and hub, incautious fellow, easily distracted, into the pit of human seeing all. The strange words we cannot live without. Here always, heat always finds the traveler, thermal inversion over Helsinki, and the canicule appalls. Rigorous alphabet of bat mitzvah, wine spilled on white satin, a letter too. But from whom, and how to pronounce it? Maniple to wipe your sweat, sudarium, that wiped the oracle of the sea, bobbing this way from Donegal 1,000 years. Heimlich maneuver on an old planet. Let us breathe again, factor. Let the light come through the wild chives on the dock rail. Let the trachea of earth ease open to breathe that gold light in. It knows to work within the relentless interior. Fractal smell of mint leaves on the windowsill. So many doors. Viable release. Gold ring on arthritic toe. Hot sand. The world isn't curative. Someone wants an answer. Not this, not that. Wants the other thing. The other word, in other words. A parachute. Fuji blimp floats quick above the island shore. So that's the first section of Fire Exit. The second in that series is a poem called Uncertainties. It has, obviously, those people who do philosophy will recognize that there's a pun on Wittgenstein's last collection on certainties, but this is uncertainties. Tell it just enough to begin. Then the form takes over and tells. Analytic balance in the box. Slide the glass open and put in the precious penny weight of human cream to measure it against a feather. Yes, but from what actual bird does such truth almost painlessly fall? Owl feather toppled from crow combat, long September color of a parson's lawn. Or was it hawk, a prairie harrier, a gull who preened up on your roof beam once? A feather is the fact of memory. What you remember is what you weigh. Your life against these Egyptian scales, maybe some god's thumb on the beam. You never know the things you know till someone tells you, then it's too late. Winter is our deciding time. The traces are runes you need to read. Find a pearl underneath your tongue. You never even touched that southern ocean. Just as fool, you never once opened up the crucifix and walked right in. So that's Uncertainties, the second of those long poems, and that's written in couplets, so to speak. The third poem is the third long poem is one called The Hexagon. And it's the hardest constraint of all, since it's written purely in one-line stanzas, if I can put it that way. Single lines. In that respect, I'm sure George Quasha, in his wonderful series of poems called Preverbs, will think I'm stealing from him. But I don't think I got around to that. But these are one-line stanzas that are grouped in six-line clusters, hence hexagon. And in a certain way, hexagon is an answer to the pentagon. in one way or another. Hexagon is a fugue, and I won't explain it further, but those of you who read the 638 sections of the Hexagon will eventually get a sense of the fugal movement of the poem. I'll just read again the first section of it, or maybe the first few. What kind of animal has me in its mind? Who is that in my mouth? Make the sound of someone speaking. I love you so much I share I. The catch of the glee assorts the owl's hour. Spring always needs to talk about wings. Two. Be kind to two, she things outside. Tie shoelaces to the trees. Down in the cellar, the black light goes on. Infamy of riding coats. Your poor fox deceased. Children dawdle to school. Grown-ups drive by them fast. Things you notice. How the keyboard cheats. Three. Shadow of the bowing arm gains shirt front. Is there a nearby animal to speak? Varicose profits in a downturn hum. I store my cable box, delete to who? This is, of course, how it yearns to speak. Come back loving, or come back all. Four. Use me every day, or silent night. Red string caught in bush, doth bird delight. Do the colors change from year to year? Does red always mean what I said? He drives in blue, a paper cup to church. May Day, the green is almost donned. Those are the first few sections of the Hexagon, which will be published any second now by the Black Widow Press, Commonwealth Books in Boston. I've read the proofs, but they haven't. The fourth book in that cycle is called Heartthread, and Christopher referred to it earlier. It's a series written in 12-line stanzas, and there are, again, many, many, many of them. I'll read just the first one again to give you a sense of how it begins. But I want to read the dedication to my wife Charlotte, which is taken from Ovid. Gives me a chance to brush up my Latin. In qua par facies nobilitatis sua, pa animo quoque forma suo respondet in illa, et genus et facies ingeniumque simu. Means she's both beautiful and smart. It's from Ovid's Fasting, that strange calendar poem. You know, Ovid, after he was banished from Rome for being too close to the emperor's daughter Julia, was banished to the Black Sea coast. I guess where what we would call Romania now, on the coast, somewhere up in there. And there he learned and wrote a poem in Gothic, the earliest recorded Germanic language. No one has ever found the poem, but he wrote one in Gothic. How wonderful it would be to find that, where the most luscious, the most rapturous of all the Latin poets, and the longest-winded, was able to write in another language. Anyway, I'll read the first couple of sections of Heartthread. Liturgical responses of all, wind and rain are answers. Let an island be a proposition in Euclid. Parse the rapture. Words that need to be said over and over to measure. If you can't count them, are they really there? Who is the enemy in an epic? Is it the king or the thought of the king? Cold knees of chivalry, brooms for breakfast and a horse, hawk aloft, small birds will flee. And here's the second one. There was an analyst who worked free. Nobody believed him. so he had nothing on his conscience. It might be a father, a lover, one's own lost self. Be kind to anyone you meet in mind's eye. Say, this is a conversation in my head with someone who isn't there. Stop this. Say what you like, but only out loud. Things can only happen once, in the mind or out there, out here. Don't use up the event imagining things like this or what he must have said. So the fifth volume of the Calls is still being worked over by me. It's written but not revised. I revise a lot and like to wait a long time before publication.
Great. Let's see. Well, to the audience, I should remind everyone that my guest today on Poet Radio is Robert Kelly. He's just read from four very recent books. They're all from the last year or two.
The Hearthread is not yet published. The one I just read, I'm reading from an advanced copy. Hexagon is just about to come out. The other two have been out for a few years. I think the whole series started within the last decade, not quite 10 years ago, but within the last decade.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them have been written on the island of Cutihunk.
Very good.
Not far off, a little island where you can see America in the distance.
That's right. That's right. Well, let me just quickly put in a plug for WGXC and this radio program. WGXC, most of you know, is a community supported community, a free, it's a radio station open to everybody, and we rely on the community support. My name is Chris Funkhauser. I do a Thursday show, third Thursday of every month, Poet Radio. And let's see. Let's go. I'd like to continue with Robert. And we were talking a little bit about writing practice and process. And you were just talking about revision. I was thinking the other night, Robert explained that he does all his writing longhand. And that he writes at the liminal hours of the day. He sometimes wakes the sun up, according to one of his poems. Mm-hmm. And then he likes to write late at night. But I was impressed by this idea that you write everything out longhand, and then you were kind of being self-deprecating, and you said, and it's ridiculous, because then I have to type it into the typewriter or the computer or whatever it is you use. But I was thinking, and hearing you talk about revision made me think that maybe that was a crucial part of the process sometimes, where if you write, there's this transcription, the self-transcription that happens from the transference of the written to the, you know, the typographic.
It works very much like that. I shouldn't say that I write only longhand. I write both longhand and compose at the keyboard. If I'm writing prose, if I have to write a review or an article or something like that, I always try to type it, because then at the computer, because otherwise it's horrendous to
revise
a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But usually in the morning I sit at the earliest time, at those liminal hours of which you speak, and write longhand, and then later copy it out. A day or two or three later, when I have a little distance from it, I'll try to type it up. But sometimes I just compose at the keyboard. When I compose at the keyboard, the lines are longer and faster.
That's interesting.
Faster. Because I write slowly, longhand. I wanted to say the word community that you describe, used in describing the radio station, caught my attention, because I wanted to mention another aspect of it. One of the wonderful things about radio, and people are so used to it they don't even know it, is that it's free. You turn on the radio. You have to buy a radio, but that usually is given. It's a part of the culture. It's there. And you listen free. And that freedom is an important issue for me. My wife, mostly, and I, to a degree, run a series of online chapbooks mm-hmm. called Madame Beeson.
Madame Beeson, yes.
She's published 45 of them so far, 45. Some of them visual, but poets of all kinds from the community, many of them local and many yeah. of them not so local. And the notion is that the internet has given us, in a Marxian phrase, the means of production. The worker has now taken over the means of production. We don't have to ask somebody else's permission to speak. We do have to plug into the internet, but, you know, we have to buy our bread, too. We can't be totally free. But the sense of producing beautifully printed chapbooks that are absolutely free to download for anybody who wants them, their business is to download them, our business is to present them. It's an idea that I think should catch on, and we'd like to see a lot of people doing that. One of the terrible things about young artists in music and writing is the extent to which they want to be bought into the economy right away without giving anything back first. You start out by giving, later they pay you. If you give two or three symphonies, they'll pay you for the fourth. Mm. You know? Mm.
I was glad you brought up the Madame Beeson. I had it in mind to announce during the program, and we should just give the address of the http://www.metambeesen.org. And indeed, many chapbooks available there. And another remarkable thing that listeners might find up there is a recently published Festschrift in your honor. Is that how you say that? Festschrift? Mm-hmm. At last count, there were tributes by nearly 90 poets around the globe, testimony to the potential and the potency of your poetic practice.
It was very moving to read that for me. I have it on my desk and I look at it every other day, reading through it. I've read through it all, of course, once, but going back and looking at it, very moving to see that. Former students, people I've never met, different, every version of connection.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Well, the nice thing I noticed about it was that it's, and this goes to your celebration of the internet, it can be added to. I didn't find out about the Festschrift until after I had seen it, but I said, I have these things. I sent it over and it gets added in. So those of you listening out there, you have been moved by or influenced by Robert and you want to contribute to a tribute. Is that right? Are we allowed to?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But be nice.
Yeah. True. So anyway, I always like that. I've been, as you probably remember, I've been working on web publishing since since the very beginning. And I've always seen this advantage to taking the means of, you know, production into my own hands. And this DIY, do-it-yourself idea, I mean, this was planted into me from my days at Naropa. And for my first, one of my biggest influences in that area was Peter Lamborn Wilson, who is now part of our community. He was always saying,
Has he been here, been interviewed?
Not yet. No, not. He and I spent a lot of time together last year recording 600 pages of his poems. But
that was extraordinary.
He hasn't been over yet. He doesn't, you know, drive. He's kind of, in a good way, a hermetic character. I mean, he's social on the scene, a town crier maybe of Woodstock and socially. But
they don't know him over there. It's amazing. He's only lived there a few years after a number of years in New Paltz and before that in New York and Tehran and Afghanistan and India and God knows where. But he reads extremely well and extremely givingly. He does not read to himself. You said hermetic, but he's not hermetic with an audience in front of him.
Right, right.
He wants to give the poem. And when I heard that you had been recording his work, I was very, very... Is that for Pen Sound?
Pen Sound, right.
Which is the great archive of recorded work. That and the EPC in Buffalo.
Well, Pen Sound is I know it's the largest archive of poetry on the internet. Yeah. But he recently read at the Opera House. You were there. It was a very animated reading. I felt that he was, you know, when he comes out, he's very, very It's a pleasant, you know, it's very...
And he sat in front of the podium rather than standing behind it.
Yes,
and he read to the audience.
So
he gave them information. Wonderful person.
I wonder what it's like. I mean, you were talking about how with the Festschrift, you look at it, you've read through it, you dip into it every now and every other day, I think you said. But this represents some... influence on your part. You've influenced the lives of many people. You've been, when I think of, you have influenced generations, right, from the 60s onward. Pierre Jory, for example, mm-hmm. was my teacher at Albany. He was your student way back when. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, we have any number of your former students out there making good names for themselves, doing righteous creative, ideological work. And I know that you also have had some kind of tangential influences on people. I remember recently hearing a story about a student, someone who took your classes, a fellow named Judd Morrissey. I don't know if you remember him. He, mm-hmm. Must have studied poetry with you. But you knew he was involved with computer programming. And then you said, you should go to Brown and study with Robert Coover. And now, lo and behold, Judd Morrissey is, a fantastic, digital artist and poet. And but he hadn't taken all the steps he had, so even through Robert Kelly. That's got to be gratifying. I guess that's what I'm getting at. And maybe that's what you were getting at when you...
Well, years ago, Gale researcher, one of those research houses, asked me to write an autobiographical essay. And the only part I really enjoyed writing was a list of all the students I could remember. Who were writing themselves. That seemed to be what the meaning of my work was, Joris and all the others, etc.
Well, this is great to talk. What I'd like to spend the last 10, 12, 13 minutes of the show with your poetry, or writing, whatever you want to read.
How about a crocodile?
Oh, you want to read the crocodile? That would be terrific to have out there. And
a man wants a crocodile. You have to give him a crocodile. There's no two ways.
I'd like to, while Robert's getting ready, I want to thank the listeners for tuning in. And... please keep in mind that the archives for this and all the shows on WGXC are available on WGXC's website, another valuable resource for people out there. Thank you for listening. Now some more words by Robert Kelly.
Crocodile. I have to tell the audience that, as they mostly know, whenever you see a picture of an alchemical laboratory, not something we see every day, you will see a stuffed crocodile floating from the ceiling above the desk or the workbench of the alchemist. One wonders why. So this piece considers that. Yikes, there's a crocodile on the ceiling. At first I thought it was flying there. No, it's slung from wires. Hard to see. Why is it there? All alchemists have a crocodile hung above their workplace. How very odd. Why? I'll tell you why. I'll tell you many reasons for this custom that strikes you as so curious. I'll give you the reasons, but it's up to you to choose the real reason, or reasons, if any. Agreed? I'm all ears. Well, a crocodile is the largest of all creatures who are completely amphibious. Air and water, earth and stream, are both congenial to it. In like manner, the alchemist, though of flesh, sometimes very much so, can dwell joyous and serene in the world of the spirit. And a crocodile on land can run 30 miles an hour over short distances, much faster than any man. Der Mensch muss sich überwinden, as Nietzsche points out. Humanity must transcend itself. And Crocodilians are the only creatures that open their mouths wide by lifting the maxilla rather than lowering the mandible. Fact. The whole skull lifts to feed. Think about it. And the crocodile is intensely and securely armored, snout to tail, safe from all attacks from above and from the side. But it is defenseless, soft, pale below. It is subject to attack from the lower realms, the lower reaches. And are we too not most at risk from our base instincts? Surely you have some of your own and some experience to confirm the truth of what I say. And through the many teeth of the crocodile, water flows, and the beast can catch and devour quite small fish and such that venture to swim past or through it, so that minute particles feed it, as well as great chunks of living matter it can seize and wrest off with its powerful jaws. It feeds on all. And the crocodile is master of rivers, is aware of every grain of gold that drifts downstream from the mines in the mountains. The crocodile seems to sleep, but is aware of everything that passes. This awareness is called a dream, and we can train to have them too. And while resting in the stream, the crocodile takes on the semblance of a log, floating or trapped in an eddy. This impersonation of a tree, an alternate variety of living thing, reminds the alchemist not to insist too strongly on the primacy of the human. People are such ontological chauvinists. They think they're the only people around. They think they're the only ones who think. The beast and the tree, the stream and the stone, they all know better. And the crocodile knows best of all. He who can be an animal, a tree, or a hummock, or hard green stone, a living vein of jade, a master of the spaces between species. Now tell me which is the real reason. It flatters me mightily that you so politely assume that I know. I'm not... Don't call in with the real reason, though.
Don't
call in with the real reason.
No. But there must have been something that, that provoked the, whether it's metaphorical or not, right?
I'm sorry?
Where did the crocodile come from?
Well, just from noticing so often in images of the alchemist, where it came
seeing
those images. Why it's actually there, I don't know. That was my attempt to reason why an alchemist might long ago have given a crocodile, hung it in his house.
Harry Smith would know.
He would have had his own ideas about it.
Yes, that's
Nobody
right.
knows anything, you know. We just say things. That's what I've been pointing out all my life. Nobody knows anything.
Deep
Thank
philosophy.
God. If we knew everything, we'd shut up and that would be the end of the matter. Then the gods would be bored and turn us off. Put a different channel on, the Martian channel would come on, or something. No, we take our strength from not knowing, but trying very hard to know. Urgently,
yes.
Urgently trying to know, but never knowing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not about knowing, it's about being. And that beingness is what we share with the wood and the tree and the beautiful green leaves that are coming out even now everywhere. Not enough yet.
This connects with the heart thread and the heart sutra. I didn't realize we were going to come all the way around to that, from your poem to the chant that I, wanted to use as the bed music today. And here we are.
Great. One of the origins of the heart thread poem was listening to the heart sutra chanted in Esperanto.
In Esperanto.
By that great American composer, Lou Harrison.
Uh-huh, okay.
Who is not much heard of now, but one of the truly wonderful composers of the mid-20th century.
He was in Santa Cruz while I was living there, Lou was. You're talking about Lou Harrison.
Sorry?
Lou Harrison?
Lou Harrison.
Right. Well, It's funny, thinking about the Heart Sutra, I used to have this LP collection of Zen chants and disappeared somehow. So I read an interesting book this past summer, Shambhala book, called Zen Chants, and it has a discussion about all the major daily chants and the ritual and event types of chants. And they finally built a website that has recordings of all the chants on them, and that was good. Shambhala.com. And then I decided to go on YouTube to see what I could find for a chance. It's in many different languages and with all kinds of orchestration. You can find all these elaborate synthesizer in all kinds of languages. I mean, I prefer, frankly, the Japanese version. The English one, which I think we'll end the show within a few minutes, is nice too, and that gets to the. I mean, we can understand that, at least the words we hear, we can understand the concepts. We don't know, right? Well, do you have another poem or two? It looks like about 4 minutes on the clock.
Let me read a Haydn piece.
Okay, great. Series.
I've been writing. To music, through music. Another practice I recommend, my practice is to begin when the music begins and stop when the music ends. And so this is written to, through the, I think it'll fit in 4 minutes, the piano trio in E major of Franz Joseph Haydn. Long story about why I'm writing to Haydn, a composer I didn't much like. So I had to figure him out. So this is the first movement. It's easy for you to say that, and kindly meant, I'm sure, but there are angels in the attic, and that strange hog-snouted demon in the cellar. We are the betweenlings, and all we know how to do is sing. Some of us can be pretty, too, or make wise remarks, pass laws, play cards, comb tenderly the fur of our cat. Children learn to do all that and more. The sad part comes, grief of war, death, and the worst of all, being a survivor and having all day long and every day sing the same song, misty music of what is left. We children can't endure being abandoned, and yet we are. We run outside, up and down the hill, pretending to play, flirt, make love, hunt flowers, and find bird nests. But all the while, the tears are seething, knowing that a day will come when no one calls us home. And when we open the door will come away in our hands. The wall will shimmer and all be Eden again with no hope, just after the beginning and no end in sight. I turn to her and ask her if she loves me. She says something that reassures both of us, and then the sun goes down. A bird we do not recognize screams in the oak, and the mail of several days lies scattered on the doorstep, and we still haven't learned yet how to read. In the second movement, once a farmer told a fortune teller, "I will give you all my barley, if you can bring her back to me." Who, the seer wanted to know. "If you don't know, you are no seer. Here, take a loaf of bread and go." Neither of us knows who she is, and whether she ever existed enough to be gone or to come home. All I know is that this is her home. Pain tells me that, and the twisted faces of neighbors who look in, pitying me and my dead house. As they pass by, here, take some butter for your dry bread. And the last movement. Of course it reminds you of rivers. Everything does. Philosophy, calculus, poetry in French class, all about flowing and going, knowing, being somewhere else. Why won't music always insist on being here, just right here, where everything really is and everything happens? Oh, dear comrades of all our perilous indoor safaris, local expeditions, dreams and desires, let me sit here in this dangerous chair to which the music comes always. pretending to be a river, the Danube, at whose source I stood and prayed, or Ganges, wide as a prairie at Patna. What can we do with a river but pray to it, or for it, and cast my own shadow onto it, time after time, until the end, and the end is still more water.
You've been listening to Robert Kelly here on WGXC. Thank you very much for coming through, Robert, and very nice to have you on the program. Thanks to Charlotte for making things happen too. And till next.
I love it that the studio where I'm sitting now is under the tallest, pointiest steeple I have ever seen. The church on the corner of Columbia and 7th, is it? Is it? Such an amazing steeple. Never seen anything like it.
No, I mean, at least in the Hudson Valley.
Well, there may be something taller, but I haven't seen it
That's
yet.
Right, that's right. Okay, very good. Until next time, be well.
And be well.
Wisdom set forth this mantra that says, Gate.